I'd like to welcome now Nancy Bartlett. She's an author and World War II historian. And Gail Okawa, she's emeritus professor of English at Youngstown State University and visiting scholar at the University of Hawaii Center for Biographical Research. And they are co-chairs of the Committee to Preserve New Mexico's Internment History and are sponsoring an event that's coming up this weekend. It's a symposium on Saturday and Sunday called From Inside and Outside the Barbed Wire, New Mexico's Multicultural World War II Internment Stories. It's at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium. Welcome, ladies, to the Radio Cafe.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
So how did you decide to put together this symposium? What are we looking forward to this weekend?
Well, this actually started with a question that I posed to then state historian Esteban Rael Galvez.
Yeah, he's fabulous.
Yes, yes. And I went and talked to him several years ago, knowing that the 10th anniversary of the marker dedication was coming up in 2012.
Now, the marker, let's talk about that for a moment, because those people who don't walk dogs extensively at the dog park might not even know about it.
I was on the committee, Joe Ondo and Doc Weaver, who is an artist here in Santa Fe, and Tom Chavez, who was then the director of the Palace of the Governors, had decided that the community needed to mark the place where the Santa Fe camp for males of Japanese descent were held. And so they formed this committee in 1998. And then in 1999, there was a resolution that was offered by Patty Boucher, who is still on the city council. She represents that district where Casa Solana, where the camp was located. And so there's a lot of discussion and controversy, but eventually the city fathers support the marker.
And why was there controversy?
The controversy came from the lack of knowledge of who was in the camp. Was it Japanese POWs who we had defeated in the Pacific, or was it civilians living in the United States? And very little information about this camp, because of being a Department of Justice camp. People didn't know. I didn't know. I had to be taught on the job, if you will, as I met with other members. And the men who had fought in the Philippines and had been POWs for 3.5 years, in the New Mexico National Guard, they felt that these men were disloyal and they should not have a monument to them.
No, they thought they were the enemy.
Right.
They thought they were POWs.
And in fact, they were men who were basically family men, regular people, American citizens who were...
Not necessarily American citizens.
Some of them were, some
they
weren't.
They were, many of them were immigrants, and American naturalization laws excluded them from citizenship. So they were, by law, non-citizens.
Right.
And therefore, when the war broke out, their immigration status changed from alien to alien enemy.
But even though, I mean, a lot of these people, and it's interesting, in one of the articles that I was reading about this, it was saying that some of them were... A few of them were highly, highly loyal to Japan. A few of them were highly loyal to the United States. And a lot of them looked at the situation as a fight between your mother and your father.
Exactly, yes.
Exactly.
Yes, I mean, because they were essentially, they were residents, in many cases, for longer than they were residents in Japan. They were residents in America for, you know, a longer period of time than they were in Japan. My grandfather was 22 when he immigrated to the United States. And he could not become a citizen because of these laws. So he was, as far as he was concerned, he was a Christian minister, and he professed Christian values as well as American values, but he could not become a citizen.
Now, was he interned during World War II?
Yes, he was here in Santa Fe. This is what got my whole research project going, in fact.
But 70% of all of the Japanese community that was... evacuated or removed from the coast were American-born children of these men who came over. And some of them had relatives who were still in Japan.
When you say the coast, you mean the Pacific?
The western coast, California, Oregon, Washington, and then Hawaii.
But they were not interned in Santa Fe. Those people were removed to, or evacuated, or whatever the euphemism is, to
war relocation centers
right. and camps, which are very different from the Department of Justice camps.
Only the fathers were sent to the Santa Fe camp.
So what was the Santa Fe camp for?
It was to remove potential spies, what would be considered spies, away from the coast where they were working or close to military installations or other careers that the government classified as potentially dangerous. And the irony was that they were brought to Santa Fe, which was to a vacated CCC camp, in the shadow of Los Alamos, which was the biggest kept secret of the whole war.
Yeah, the huge irony there.
Huge mm-hmm. irony. And these men were never accused of any crime. They were just, by virtue of their profession, their standing in the community, and other insensitive cultural misunderstandings were rounded up.
Because they were, in fact, community leaders and very educated in large part. Cultured men, but because of that status, because they were businessmen, ministers, teachers, school teachers,
journalists, writers,
but mm-hmm. people who had influence.
Right. And so they were taken away, brought to Santa Fe without their families.
Yes.
That's correct.
Yes.
Or they were fishermen, too, who could, because of having boats, could go from the coast to German boats that would be sighted off the Pacific coast.
So when they were brought here, what happened then? Were they just stuck here for the whole war? How long did they stay? What were their lives like?
Well, most of them went through various kinds of routes. It meant the ones from California may have gone to other camps before they finally were located in Santa Fe. The men from Hawaii, who are the men I'm studying, among them my grandfather, were sent first to Angel Island in San Francisco Bay. Some of them went from there to Fort Sam Houston in San Antonio, then to Lordsburg, and then to Santa Fe.
Good heavens.
Yes, but others went all the way to Wisconsin, were sent to Wisconsin, to Camp Forest, Tennessee, to Fort Sill, Oklahoma, to Camp Livingston, Louisiana, and then to Santa Fe. I mean, there were just crazy routings or routings.
Was this years of their lives?
Yes. Yes. Many of them were arrested on December 7th. The time that Pearl Harbor was being bombed, there were lists. The FBI had lists of people for actually a number of years before the war. So this tends to essentially negate the fact that there was a surprise attack.
Yeah, it does make one wonder. Why were they keeping lists?
Yeah, they were keeping lists. FDR actually issued a letter or a memo to one of his underlings to keep lists in case of some kind of national security problem, and so that men should be put, these people on these lists would be put in concentration camps. Use the term concentration camps. And this happened 5 years before Pearl Harbor.
The naval intelligence also had been watching and sharing with the FBI, and there was indeed spying going on, but it was men who were Japanese in the Japanese naval service who came as students and collected materials. And then there were non-Japanese spies that were picked up and taken to trial. But the America knew, because we had broken the Japanese code magic, that the Japanese were not going to be using people of Japanese descent on American soil as spies, because they were afraid that that would reflect on the whole community, and that would be a bad thing. So there was a Munson report that the president was given saying the Japanese would be loyal to their new home, but the war the people in the War Department overcame that report, and it issued the executive order that had all of the Japanese removed.
But that wasn't until February 19th of 1942. So in other words, between the bombing of Pearl Harbor and the executive order, you know, there had been a lot of preliminary work done by the War Department, the State Department, these other government agencies, sort of preparing for some kind of conflict.
Average age was 52 of the first group that came in 42 and 43, 44. And they, as Gail described, they were moved around. The Santa Fe camp was a detention camp, and the men were detained and processed. They had there was a hearing, a 15-minute hearing, which was really not considered to be an appropriate hearing under our civil liberties and what we expect civil liberties, because they did not have an attorney or assistance. But they were processed.
It's just like immigrants today. They're put in these immigration prisons, mm-hmm. and they don't have a right to an attorney because it's a civil rather than a criminal system. And they can languish there forever. This is the one of the many precursors to that. When they were in the Santa Fe camp, which is what you have studied, did you talk to your grandfather about it? Did he tell you?
No. This is the big, I guess, disappointment of my life.
Yeah.
I really didn't know that he had been interned. And I was in high school when I found out from a neighbor. And at the time, I ran home and I talked to my parents, and all they said was he came back a changed man. But it was, you know, we weren't supposed to talk about it after that. It was pretty clear.
Yeah.
So I never talked to him about it. And the other aspect of this, of course, is I thought he spoke only Japanese. And I didn't realize until I started doing this research how well-versed he was in English.
Very interesting.
Because he lived on another island. You know, we didn't live in the same place, so we didn't see him that often. But that's one of the greatest regrets of my life, is that I never had a chance to talk to him.
Were you able to talk to other people who were interned in Santa Fe?
Yes. I mean, my research has really been concerned with finding people who were either interned themselves or families of internees. So I have done a number of interviews to learn about their experience.
And what were their lives like here? What were their days like?
Oh, well, I think the greatest bane of their lives was boredom. You know, they were here for years. So what they tried to do was to resist in different ways. In one of the documents I read, they called it barbed wire disease. And they did whatever they could to essentially busy themselves in different ways. Some of the activities were very Japanese, you know, Japanese painting, Japanese calligraphy, Japanese no drama chanting, Japanese theater. They would, you know, actually make costumes and so on and perform. This was apparently a huge entertainment factor in the camps. But then they also did very American things. They played baseball. I mean, that was a huge pastime.
Golf,
tennis,
hiking.
So it wasn't exactly a high. I mean, it was a security prison in the sense that they couldn't get out, but they tried to make their lives fairly reasonable.
Yes.
The Geneva Convention was the key factor here.
Right, which doesn't always mean that people follow it, as we've seen in the last 10 years. Yeah,
right.
But very well here. And the men were allowed out if they had good behavior, good in quotations, outside the camp for hiking. and for horseback riding, different kinds of things like that. And there was a roll call at 9 o'clock at night, and then after a while they asked that that be discontinued. There really wasn't a need for it. The men weren't going to go anywhere. Mm-hmm. Now, some of them did go out and work in the community for 80 cents a day, which is what the convention said they should be paid. The Italian and the German POWs were also paid the same amount. Mm-hmm. And they worked inside the camp. There were doctors and dentists who were allowed to practice in the camp. And there were cooks and people who kept the camp going, in addition to the guards who were local, who were hired to guard.
Now, they got some visits from family members from time to time.
Yes, or they were allowed to go if someone in the family had some emergency from time to time.
Well, actually, the visits, though, are you saying that they were allowed to go out?
I believe so.
I don't know about that. But,
okay, well, we'll look it up.
Yeah, but there were visitors allowed, of course, highly scrutinized visitors. But one of the main groups I've researched are the sons who were actually in the military.
I know, that's another irony. American soldiers
yes.
visiting their detained
exactly.
fathers.
Yes. And because I'm focusing on the Hawaii immigrant internees, what I have found is that many of the military sons who were either in the 100th Battalion or the 442nd Regimental Combat Team or the Military Intelligence Service, they were all, many of them volunteered, especially from Hawaii. Some of them volunteered out of the camps, out of the so-called relocation camps. Some of them came to see their fathers because they were able to, you know.
They were on their way out overseas, and yeah. they came to say goodbye. Abel Nishimura refused to serve unless his family and his father were allowed to go home and leave the camps. And Bill is going to be 92 this month, and he's coming, and he will share his experiences on Sunday afternoon. But he's very, very adamant about he lost his citizenship because of it. They moved his father around to try to convince him, because he had Japanese language as well as English. They wanted him to work in the military service in the Pacific, as thousands of the young men whose families were interned were signed up to do. And women, there were young girls too in the military intelligence service who were bilingual. So it's a very, very complex story, mm-hmm. and it's wonderful. And we hope all of Santa Fe that can come out will come out, because we've set this up for 2 days because you can't tell the whole story in one.
Yeah, we're talking about the symposium called From Inside and Outside the Barbed Wire, New Mexico's Multicultural World War II Internment Stories. It's this weekend, Saturday and Sunday, at the New Mexico History Museum Auditorium. And let's talk just for a moment about outside the barbed wire. One of the things in one of these articles was that the people of Santa Fe, a lot of the people of Santa Fe, were really against the camp and thought that the enemy was in their midst. And there were people, I mean, one of the reasons people didn't escape was because they were safer inside the camp
That's
than
right.
going into Santa Fe. Mm-hmm.
At one time, yes. The townspeople came up when they found out about the treatment of their young men in the National Guard by the Japanese military overseas. They stormed the camp with pickaxes and sticks, and the commander convinced them to go home, and these men were not responsible for what happened to their boys, and it would be better if they left. And so they did, but the men were frightened to death.
Mm-hmm. And I think it was the camp commander at the time was Ivan Williams, who apparently was very wise in the way he talked to the people who were demonstrating.
Yes.
I think one of the main things he talked about was the importance of the Geneva Convention, and that, you know, that if the the men in the camp were harmed, it would create greater problems for some of the men in their lives, you know, their children, their sons, and so on. So he was able to dissuade them from the riot, but it was a serious problem.
Indeed. Now, the camp here in Santa Fe was finally closed in 1946. Why were there still prisoners after the war was over?
Well, they had to have letters of transport and have someone to sponsor them when they left the camp. Some were sent down to Crystal City to join their families who had volunteered to go there so that they could try to connect with their husbands' fathers. I don't know all the reasons for it, but it was basically they had, because they'd lost their property and couldn't go back home, that, and it just took time to process. Some didn't want to leave. But Bill was one of the last to leave because his father had gotten ill. His father and he were in the camp at the end of the war, and his dad was sick, and so he had some kind of stomach cancer. And so they lingered until close to the very end.
Apparently, a lot of it did have to do with government paperwork. And so there were men who were there. I think many of them left in November of 1945.
Yes.
I have manifests of the shiploads that were sent back. So especially the men from Hawaii, a lot of them left in November of 1945. And I think that had to do with, you know, when the ships were going to be available and that kind of thing.
What happened all this time to their wives and children and their houses and their lives they were separated from?
The men from the West Coast, of course, all of their families were locked up in the WRA camps. As far as the people
from Hawaii.
There were 10 of those. The people from Hawaii, many of them, there were sort of two different groups. Some who had businesses and so on, and children who were old enough to actually take care of them, you know, wives or children who were able to continue their businesses. But there were also those who had very young children. And what they attempted to do was to be reunited with their families in other camps. So there were deals made, apparently, between the War Relocation Authority and the Justice Department.
So they may have lost their jobs, their houses, their possessions.
Yes.
But they were able to spend at least some of those years with their wives and children.
In some cases.
Mm-hmm. The camp went down to about 200-some in 46 before it closed. And at one time, there were over 2,000 in the camp. Mm-hmm. They had expanded the camp from the CCC beds of 450 to about 2,000.
Mm-hmm. Where was it in Santa Fe?
It was where Casa Solana residential area is.
So right all those now. Streets up on West Alameda, there were no houses there?
Right.
That was a camp.
Yeah, that was where the camp
that's
was?
That's where the CCC camp was.
Yes.
And so, in other words, the current marker at the dog park is making reference to that whole area below the marker, which is Casa Solana now. And that's where the camp was.
Alan Stamm bought the land back from the New Mexico prison and built a very nice subdivision where some of the men coming back from the war started living in the homes, and so did Manuel Armijo and other veterans who were POWs in Japanese camps. In fact, there's one who is still alive who lives in that neighborhood.
Is that right?
Who supports the marker, yes.
So the event is called From Inside and Outside the Barbed Wire, New Mexico's Multicultural World War II Internment Stories. And Nancy Bartlett is an author and World War II historian. Gail Okawa is an emeritus professor of English and visiting scholar at the University of Hawaii Center for Biographical Research. And they are co-chairs of the Committee to Preserve New Mexico's Internment History. And once again, the symposium is on Saturday and Sunday, starting at 10:30 in the morning, a civilized hour, at the New Mexico History Museum. For tickets, you can go to ticketssantafe.org or call 988-1234. And I guess you can also just show up.
You can just show up.
Mm-hmm. Well, I want to thank you both so much for being with us.
Thank you. Thank you so much.